You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from Tanzina Vega, host of The Takeaway, which starts airing here on the Ideas Network on Monday. Now, think about the last time your child or your parent or grandparent said something funny or something they thought was funny or showed you one of their favorite comedy movies or sitcoms. If you found yourself a bit confused about what was supposed to be funny, you are not alone. Connecting with another generation's humor can be tough. There's a big difference between the TV shows of the past and the TikTok memes of today. But some research shows that our senses of humor may also change as we age, making a universally funny joke really hard to come by. Our next guest has looked into how our humor changes as we get older and what types of jokes land best with different generations. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a type of humor, a show, a movie in particular, that falls flat from one generation to another for you? Or is there something that brings together all generations of your family or group of friends or coworkers? Call in at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Stanley is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Akron, where she directs the Emotions and Aging Lab. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this could feel like something we sort of know anecdotally, but it sounds like there are some measurable, even testable differences in our senses of humor. What got you interested in studying this as part of your broader work on emotions and aging?
Actually, another research article that was published a few years before this one got me interested because they found age differences in people's understanding of humor in the British sitcom The Office, the British version of it. And they found that older adults were less likely to understand the social gaffes that were being made by the main character. I think his name is David in that version. And young adults were better able to understand what was happening, those social gaffes that David was creating. And so I was interested in investigating that more to see if I could replicate the finding and maybe discover why we saw those age differences.
And one thing that seems like it'd be really hard to tease out is, you know, are there differences between different generations, like millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers? Or is the difference how old you are? And maybe we all go through, I don't know, different stages of humor comprehension. How do you start to separate that out?
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. And in my study and the previous paper, we weren't able to tease them apart because we both used a cross-sectional design. So we both were just looking at today's young adults and comparing them to today's older adults. So that doesn't tell you if it's something that changes across a person's lifespan or if it's something about being part of that generation that just a certain type of thing tickles your funny bone, specific to that cohort.
Well, I want to check out some of the comedy that was part of your own research. This is the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, and here's Larry David asking his waiter how much a friend left for a tip on their last visit.
I was in here. I was with a guy. I'm just curious. What do they leave?
It was a healthy tip.
Was mine a healthy tip?
Yeah.
Was his healthier? Let me ask you this question. Was it over $12?
Do you want me to refill your water? Or?
Just scratch your face with your finger if it was over $12.
So that's in that kind of like The Office, that awkward brand of humor. Is there a different age breakdown on how we react to that kind of cringeworthy humor?
There seems to be. And that was my main question with our study, was to look at whether there were age differences in an appreciation for that sort of awkward, aggressive humor style where it's someone committing social gaffes. And often at the expense of another person. So in The Office, a lot of the humor is sort of at the other character's expense. And so it turned out that older adults understood why it was supposed to be funny and what was happening in clips like The Office and Curb Your Enthusiasm, but they just didn't think it was as funny as young adults and middle-aged adults.
We're talking about the appeal of different kinds of humor to different age groups. Jennifer Stanley is tackling some of those questions, associate professor to the Department of Psychology at the University of Akron. And you bring up this phrase in some of your research, something that older people in your studies anyway liked was something more, as opposed to laughing at people, affiliative humor. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, so that was sort of another really interesting finding from this paper is that in addition to watching these clips of situation comedies and rating how funny they were, Participants also did a self-report questionnaire on their humor style, like what type of humor they prefer. And this questionnaire assessed people on four different humor styles. So there's affiliative, which is humor that is intended to bring people together. There's self-enhancing humor, which is humor that makes yourself look good. Aggressive humor, which is what I thought was depicted in these situation comedies. And then self-defeating humor, which is maybe like self-deprecating type of humor. And then we found that older adults rated themselves higher than young adults on affiliative humor and lower than young adults on aggressive humor.
Do you have thoughts on why that might be?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I mean, that's sort of what I'm most interested in following up on is there some sort of, if we think about humor as having a functional role in our lives, is there some reason maybe developmentally that the function of humor would change such that it would be more advantageous to prefer affiliative humor over aggressive humor when we get older? Maybe because older age is accompanied by so many losses in different domains, such as in the cognitive, physical, and even social domain. You know, maybe we are driven to pay more attention to affiliative humor as we get older.
I want to give a listen to a particular movie that is comedy quotable gold for men, I think in particular of a certain age. This is Caddyshack from 1980.
I want you to kill every golfer on the course.
Check me if I'm wrong, Sandy, but if I kill all the golfers, they're going to lock me up and throw away the key.
Golfers! You great kid, not golfers! The little brown furry rodents!
We can do that.
Hey!
We don't even have to have a reason.
Do it, man!
All right, let's do the same thing, but with gophers.
Gosh!
It's not my fault nobody can understand what you're saying.
You don't even need a reason. Now, I think of that as affiliative humor, but in a different way. If people are sharing a common reference of humor and quoting it back and forth of each other, you kind of bring yourselves together, whatever the style of the humor is. I know that's outside of the direct research you've done, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think, you know, people having a shared common ground, you know, having that experience of people in the same generation all having watched the same type of humorous shows can bring people together. And, you know, maybe that has less to do with the particular humor style of the clip and more to do with just, you know, this is a way, something we all can remember from back in the day.
We asked our listeners to provide some data on this and how different types of comedy play with different generations at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Katie in Eau Claire. Katie, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. When I was a little girl, my grandmother had introduced me to Carol Burnett, and I fell in love with watching the reruns of the show. And I'm now in my late 30s, and I have a 7-year-old myself, and I sat her down the other day because she very much has a humor style of Carol Burnett, and I was thinking she's going to fall in love with the show, she's going to watch it, and it's going to be awesome, and we're just going to die of laughter together. And she watched 2 episodes, and I showed her the episode of the dentist scene, and she just turned to me and said, "I don't get it."
Oh, no. Did you figure out why, Katie, or was just one of those things?
You know, I don't know if it was just because of the way it was filmed or it just looked older or I have no idea. But I just turned to her and went, "Really?" And she went, "No, I don't get it." And I was like, "Well, you're missing out because this is fantastic." So,
Katie, thank you so much. I know as a parent, sometimes I've made the mistake of overselling something and then the kid just doesn't want to like it from the get-go. I don't know, it's different things, and maybe it's if you're a kid who's used to watching a TikTok video or something, the staging might throw you off. Do you have thoughts on that, Jennifer?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it brings up a really good point that when we see age differences in people's preferences for different types of humor, just like, you know, Katie with her daughter, it might not be an age difference in the ability to understand the humor as much as just sort of, I have a different style or a different preference that I'm more likely to recognize as humorous. And maybe it has to do with familiarity too. Like, how familiar are you with that medium? So if people are watching TikTok videos, like you say, those are going to be these short 1-minute, you know, clips with these great visuals, which differs a lot from situation comedies and things like that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Katie. We're talking to Jennifer Stanley, associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Akron. She directs the Emotions and Aging Lab there. We're talking about how comedy hits differently with people of different ages, different generations. You can provide us with your own stories at 800-642-1234. Have you ever felt like another generation's sense of humor is confusing or just not that funny? Has it ever made you feel left out, maybe amongst your family, friends, or coworkers? Or do you have something that bridges the comedy gap between generations? What is it? Why do you think it works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with Jennifer Stanley, psychology professor and director of the Emotions and Aging Lab at the University of Akron, looking at why humor can differ from one generation to the next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed different generations having their own sense of humor? What do you think is behind that? Is there something you just don't think is funny that younger people or older people do? Or is there something that bridges the gap for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Don is with us in DeForest. Don, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I have two things to say. First of all, our favorite comedy movie, hands down, is called Undercover Blues. It's Dennis Quaid, Kathleen Turner are the stars, but Stanley Tucci just steals the show. We watch it once a year, and it never fails to cause guffaws and chuckles, and it's just a really funny movie. And we've turned on our friends, we turn on our kids' friends to it. It's just really universally loved. I think one of the things it has going for it is it pitches to the sort of highbrow and the lowbrow. It's got a very sort of wide sense of humor, if you will. And I highly recommend it. It's just a great movie. The other thing I was going to say is I find that probably once or twice a year I get into conversation with somebody about Saturday Night Live, and you know, everyone thinks that, you know, ours was the best, and it's just you know, really gone to pot since, you know.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a lot to work with there. Let's start with that idea that my generation of Saturday Night Live was the funny one in all since aren't. Maybe it's, you know, they're all hitting, they're aiming for a certain age range and speaking their language, Jennifer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there's also something about, you know, thinking about the TikTok videos and things like that. It's sort of, it does seem like it hits on, yeah, speaking their language, what's happening that's relevant to young people at that current time. And so maybe that's something, that style you carry with you as you get older. I think there's something to that for sure.
And with his favorite family movie, Undercover Blues, in that case, but it speaks to, you know, he and his family watched it. It's a shared language that they participate in. And it makes me think about, you know, the older people in your studies watching, say, The Office, if they haven't been watching that style of humor, you know, maybe they just haven't developed that particular comedy language that the younger participants have.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an awesome study to do, to just, because it could just be, I'm just not familiar with this sort of a strange type of humor. And so maybe the more you watch it, the more you like it. My husband didn't like it when he first watched it. And so I think that would be an interesting study to do. And hey, bringing in people to have them watch situation comedy sounds like a fun study for everybody.
But it sounds like it's really easy to talk about comedy and, you know, how it works through the generations. It's a lot tougher than I would have thought to study it. What kind of research would you do if, you know, you had all the time and money to do it?
Oh, wow. That would be a great situation. I think, you know, one of these major questions that we've already hit on, is this something developmental or is it something generational? And so it would be really fun to do a longitudinal study where I could test today's young people and follow them every 5 years and test them on different types of humor and see if their humor style changes as they bit older. Another thing that would be really interesting to do would be, and we could also use archival data, looking back at maybe famous comedians, stand-up comedians, and looking at what their humor style was when they were in their 20s, and then did that change as they got older? So that would be my first question that I'd love to answer.
Let's go back to our callers. Bill is on the line in Superior. Bill, hi. Oop, do we have you there? It looks like we lost Bill. Bill, I've got a quote from him, though. Dad jokes, he says, become more popular lately, maybe because they're irritating to younger generations. And thinking of dad jokes, you had that category, I think, self-defeating humor. Part of the humor in the dad joke is the joke itself, and part of it, I think, as a dad joke teller since way before I was a dad, is kind of a self-deprecating angle of humor.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And that's what, you know, I'm not on TikTok a bunch, but from what I've seen, a lot of the TikTok videos also seem to have that self-defeating, self-deprecating element where, you know, kind of people share really embarrassing things that have happened with them. And maybe that does, you know, tend to bring people together because we can all sort of identify with having really embarrassing moments.
Thanks a lot for calling it and sharing that thought that we lost you on the line there. Jennifer Stanley is with us from the University of Akron. She studies how our emotions change as we age. We're talking about some of her research on humor and how different age groups react to different types of humor. Let's go back to your calls. Ed in West Allis is with us. Ed, hi.
Let's just state the obvious. The Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields are the two greatest comedy team and comedian in the history of this country, especially Night at the Opera, especially the stateroom scene. We made a really bad turn circa 1966, and you can see this in how George Carlin turned in his stand-up comedy when we broached the sexual topics, and Seinfeld is constantly riddled with sexual entendre that in the end is pathetic and not funny.
Ed, thanks a lot for the call, and make it three hard-boiled eggs. Jennifer, that's interesting. Judging the content now and the sexual content in that case turns Ed away from a lot of kinds of humor. Is that something you encountered when you talked to a research subject? There were just kinds of subject matter that turned their funny bones right off?
There did seem to be an element of, you know, maybe pushing the envelope or approaching these taboo topics that they didn't necessarily find funny. They just thought it was offensive and sort of maybe kind of lowbrow, you know, going with the lowest common denominator, like just because it's racy and you can't believe you would say that, that that is what makes it funny. And so there did seem to be sort of a difference in the appreciation for well thought out humor that wasn't sort of the lowest common denominator versus maybe more racy, taboo type topics.
Thanks for calling in, Ed. We'll go to KB now in La Crosse. KB, hello.
Good afternoon. How are you doing, guys?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Hey, one of the previous callers talked about setting her daughter down to watch, you know, Carol Burnett and stuff. My father used to do that with me when I was really young, but he always warned me, I would call it a warning, that the humor isn't slapstick humor like Stooges or Bugs Bunny. The humor is more subtle. You have to pay attention. And that was one of the things that I had learned to do with him as a young kid, and it got me to appreciate so many of the different kinds of humor, be it slapstick or the subtle humor like Peter Sellers or Carol Burnett, or, you know, movies like What's Up, Doc? Or Murder by Death, you know, movies like that. I created, you know, a real deep appreciation for the different forms of humor to the point where I appreciate that stuff more than I almost appreciate the stuff that's out there now.
KB, thank you so much for sharing that. I love it. And that's something I don't think you got into particularly, Jennifer, but that idea of, you know, slapstick, which you don't need, you can kind of get, I think, walking into it versus, you know, picking up on those more subtle, maybe verbal and wordplay cues. Do you have thoughts on how that, I don't know, would that be different from generation to generation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I really get his point, because that would be a very interesting study to do, is to just say, well, you might not be familiar with a specific type of humor, but the more and more you watch it, you tend to start finding it funnier and funnier, or is it just, you know, you never really see the funny side? And so knowing what to expect and what type of humor to expect might play a big role in what you find funny.
All right, Jennifer, in our last half a minute or so, do you have a favorite go-to comedic form from any era?
Oh, boy. I mean, I do have to say, I've watched the entire Office. I think I watched the entire thing again recently, you know, during the pandemic. And I really do find it pretty funny, even though I guess it's aggressive humor. So I'm not sure what that says about me.
And do you think it might change as you get older?
I do. I expect it to change as I get older.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Stanley is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Akron, where she directs the Emotions and Aging Lab. We talked with her about how our senses of humor can change as we get older. Coming up after the news, Tanzina Vega, host of The Takeaway, shares why she's committed to being truthful instead of neutral. And we'll get a preview of The Takeaway, which starts airing next Monday on the afternoon here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A conservative legal group in Wisconsin is suing Governor Evers over his second COVID-19 emergency declaration. Coming up, we talk to a lawyer from that group about why he says the mask mandate is illegal. Now, the weekday afternoon lineup here on the Ideas Network is changing. Science Friday stays the same. Starting next week, Monday through Thursday, we'll hear an hour of On Point at 1 o'clock, and then The Takeaway airs at 2. The Takeaway is a national daily news program, and the focus is on bringing together perspectives and experiences from across the country. Tanzina Vega hosts The Takeaway. She talked to WPR host Keely Boltina.
What kinds of conversation can people hear when they listen to The Takeaway?
One of the things that I grounded the show in when I started as host was there were three gaps in American society that really inform all of the reporting that we do. And what I mean by that is there is an empathy gap, there is a wealth gap, and there is a truth gap. And what we aim to do is ground all of our work with that in the background, understanding how we can close some of these gaps. So a lot of our work focuses on the news of the day, but it's not just telling you what just happened. What we're trying to do is offer you some analysis, some insight, some nuance, and some depth to what you're already probably inundated by in more commercial media. So that's essentially the type of conversation that we're trying to have. And we're also trying to make sure that the people that we interview are diverse in and of themselves when we're talking about points of view. Not always, you know, we have everybody from folks at the New York Times to, you know, people in local communities weighing in on what they think. And a big portion of the show is also our listeners.
Yeah. How much does audience participation play into these shows?
Audience participation is key, and there are many different ways that we ask for people to join us in the conversation. One of the ways, and you'll hear me talking about this every day on the show, is they can just call us. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. That line is open for you to call us pretty much about anything. We often ask listener questions on social media. We ask people to call us in terms of what they're thinking of the news of the day. And for those who really want to stay connected with The Takeaway at a more in-depth level, we also have a text messaging network. And that will allow producers and people on our team to reach out to folks and say, hey, you know, are you interested in weighing in on this particular topic? People who want to engage with the show that way can text START, S-T-A-R-T, to the number 69866.
Some listeners here in Wisconsin may not have heard much of The Takeaway. It's a new program for us. So here's a quick listen from a conversation you had earlier this month.
As the coronavirus ravages communities across the United States, another epidemic continues to unfold in the background, the opioid crisis. Last year, preliminary data from the CDC showed that nearly 72,000 people died from an overdose. The majority of those were opioid-related. And during the pandemic, the situation may be worsening.
We're living in this pandemic, and still other crises haven't subsided. How does your team approach and balance intersecting issues?
One of the things I try to avoid is what I call the bright, shiny object syndrome, where a lot of media, particularly if you're looking at breaking news, is covering whatever just happened. And what happens there is that it's important to make sure we're covering as quickly as possible developing stories across the country. But one of the things I'm interested in is making sure that we don't lose sight of the long tail of many of the other issues that are compounding us right now. The coronavirus is one thing that we've continued to report on. But don't forget, just a couple of months ago, just even a year ago, we were talking about the opioid crisis. We were talking about the Mueller report. You know, these aren't things that just disappear. They're things that the media might pivot on, you know, once it's no longer the hot thing to talk about. And at The Takeaway, we actually think that that's not the way to go. What we want to do is make sure that we haven't forgotten about the long tail of some of these stories and how these ideas and these issues are intersecting, you know, especially when we look at things like inequality, when we look at things even like the coronavirus, right? Where are there different peaks and valleys? What communities are most affected? Which ones aren't? And oftentimes on The Takeaway, we tend to have these conversations a little bit earlier than mainstream media might be doing.
Tanzina Vega hosts The Takeaway. It's coming to the Ideas Network starting Monday, and you can listen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon every Monday through Thursday. Tanzina, Wisconsin has had some experiences with journalists from the coast not taking time to understand what life is like here. How do you make sure that you're talking with everyone in the country?
Well, again, that's another big part of The Takeaway. I used to be a national reporter at The New York Times. And when I did that, particularly covering the issue of race in this country, one of the most important things to do was not to stay in New York and to make sure that we're getting out across the country and traveling across the country. Right now, obviously, with the coronavirus, we're limited in where we can be physically. Before that, we were making sure that we were visiting sister stations across the country and doing reporting on the ground at those places. We, you know, really try not to have that sort of coastal bias that I think a lot of folks, might be a little bit more myopic on, and really try to make sure that we are getting people from those communities to talk to us and not just taking the sort of 35,000 foot view about what's happening.
Well, you mentioned your career focused on reporting on race and inequality. What's different now than when you've reported on those issues in the past?
Well, I think one of the things I often think about is when I pitched this idea at the New York Times, it was before the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And so the issues that we were thinking about then, I think, had not really reached the fever pitch in the public consciousness as far as the, you know, criminal justice reform and other things, you know, systemic inequality, the racial wealth gap. And they were things that I think people were talking about, mostly in academic or activist circles, but they hadn't really reached the kitchen table of most Americans. If you fast forward to today, to 2020, and we look at what has happened with the rise of the uprising for racial justice across the country, how the movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter has morphed into something that is no longer, you know, ignored by top political candidates, whether they're for it or against it. If you look at the conversations that so many people are having today who are saying things like, you know, systemic inequality, who are invoking those types of that type of language, that tells me that there has been a shift in the awareness of so many of these issues that that Americans, you know, may or may not have wanted to talk about. I think another thing that's shifted is we're talking about, you know, almost a decade of work that I've been doing in this space. And, you know, social media has evolved significantly in that time. And so we're now, you know, a lot of these issues, especially when we're talking about police brutality, a lot of these issues aren't new. What they are is that they're being shown. We are seeing seeing these things playing out. We're seeing with our own eyes the police injustice that's happening around the country and other things that are happening. We're seeing, you know, incidences like some folks are calling them the Karen incidences, right, where people are calling the police on Black people and people of color for various, you know, minor issues. And so our consciousness, I think, has been altered in many ways, and it's forcing us to really adjust our lens and not be able to ignore what we may have been able to just sweep under the rug, you know, a decade or two ago.
Last year, you mentioned that you were inspired by journalist Christiane Amanpour saying that she tries to be truthful, not neutral. Why does that resonate with you?
I think one of the things that journalists have been accused of, and I think this was one of the tenets of journalism, at least in its traditional form, is this idea of objectivity. And so there was a need, I think many journalists, in particular younger journalists, may have felt to, if we interview this person, then we must interview that person who has the opposing view. That can only take you so far. And I think, as I mentioned at the top of our conversation, one of the things that the takeaway is really looking at is the truth gap, you know, between, and which I think is quite, you know, almost unprecedented for many of us who've never really dealt with this level of bending of the truth, of lying, you know, coming from, you know, our presidential administration, coming from the sources that we get on social media, you know, things that news articles that we thought might, you know, our trust in the media has been shaken. And so I think that right now it's paramount to be able to say we can't just, you know, it's no longer business as usual. The stakes have changed. And the cards that we're all playing with have changed, and we need to be able to adapt to that. And the only way to do that is to remain in some areas, you know, truthful. And that may mean, you know, we don't necessarily have an A and or B conversation. Not everything is as simple as that. And it requires longer conversations. It requires more depth of a conversation. It's not something that you can just tweet, you know, 140 or 260 characters and get to the bottom of. And that's where I think the you know, it's simpler to say to remain neutral, quote unquote, if you're trying to just, you know, posit A against B. It's much more difficult to try and get to a place of authentic, you know, reality for what's really happening on the ground. And I think that's what the takeaway is striving to do, while at the same time, you know, maintaining its editorial and journalistic standards.
We will certainly be listening. Tanzina, thank you for your time.
We are so excited, Wisconsin. Thank you for having us, and we hope to serve you well.
That was The Takeaway host, Tanzina Vega, talking with WPR host Keeley Boltina. You can hear The Takeaway here on the Ideas Network starting August 31st. Just tune in Monday through Thursday at 2 in the afternoon. For a list of that and other program changes here at Wisconsin Public Radio, head over to our website and look at WPR.org/fall2020. Coming up, we'll talk to the group that's suing Governor Evers over his current emergency declaration, the one that opened the door for the statewide mask mandate. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the USA Today Network named Women of the Century in each state and the District of Columbia to commemorate the anniversary of women's suffrage. We'll learn about Wisconsin's top 10 list coming up. First, a conservative legal group here in Wisconsin has filed a lawsuit that could ultimately strike down the state's mask mandate. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, said the issue isn't so much with the masks themselves, but that Governor Evers overstepped his authority on issuing a second COVID-19 emergency declaration. The first was in March when the Department of Health Services issued the stay-at-home orders. The mask mandate started late last month and is set to expire on September 28th. WILL says a governor can only make one emergency declaration per crisis. Evers says because the status of the virus changed since the first one ended, it's okay to issue a new one. Lucas Weber is deputy counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program. It's great to be here.
Well, I gave a quick summary version of the lawsuit. Can you spell it out a little more for us?
Yeah, I think that was a great introduction. As you said, Wisconsin state law allows the governor to have certain emergency powers that he can use to address emergency situations. Here in Wisconsin, back in March, Governor Evers declared a state of emergency. He then, under the statute, gets those emergency powers for a period of 60 days. At the end of that 60-day period, unless the legislature has extended that emergency, those powers expire. Governor Evers used those powers for 60 days. They expired back in May. At the end of July, just a month ago, Governor Evers declared a second state of emergency and grabbed those powers for purportedly another 60 days. And as you mentioned, one of the orders that he used those powers to issue was the mask mandate, but he certainly could issue others. He has not yet. And our lawsuit, we represent three Wisconsinites, three Wisconsin residents and taxpayers who are challenging the legality of the governor's actions. State law is very clear that it's limited to 60 days unless legislative approval is given. That was not given here. It's undeniable that it wasn't given here. And so we believe the governor has broke the law, and we're asking the court to declare as much.
And at least in some of your public statements on this, you're saying this isn't asking for a judgment on the value or usefulness of the mask mandate itself. It's more the underlying authority issue that you're concerned about.
Yeah, this lawsuit is not about whether government has the power to require individuals to wear masks or not. Certainly, if we were to win this lawsuit, that order would be based on an unlawful emergency declaration, and it would be invalid. But there are local mask mandates all around the state that would stay in force. There are also other lawful ways that the governor could use to try and invoke a mask mandate statewide. He could call the legislature into special session for it. He could direct one of his agencies to promulgate a rule as a couple of examples. But he hasn't done, for his own reasons, those ways. He's decided to simply declare what he wants the law to be. And under Wisconsin, he can only do that for one 60-day period. And he's already used that 60-day period.
And the argument from the governor's office, I think, goes along the lines of, we had an initial crisis with COVID-19. We were looking pretty good. It was under control, apparently, for a while there. We've got this new flare-up. It's a new phase of the same illness. Do you see the potential that a court might agree with them?
No, I mean, I can certainly understand, you know, why they'd want to make that argument. But, you know, the statute doesn't provide for that. The statute says that he can declare, you know, one 60-day state of emergency for a public health emergency. The public health emergency now is the exact same that it was back in March. It's COVID-19. The statute doesn't make any exemptions for that, for getting worse or anything along those lines. That's the only exemption the statute makes to the 60-day time limit is if the legislature chooses to extend it, which they have not done here.
We got a lot of comments from people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Many of them, people who support having a mandate, thinking it would be a mistake to get rid of it. If the effect of getting rid of the mandate were a flare-up of COVID-19, and this is a complicated health issue, we don't know whether that would be the case, but would that be a case to be made that the governor had it right, that this was a new crisis, that if we get rid of this mask mandate, things go bad, it was a mistake to overturn this authority?
Yeah, I mean, again, there are lawful ways for the governor to implement that policy if he wants to do that. The governor, again, for his own reasons, has chosen not to avail himself of those lawful ways that he could have tried to do this. So, no, I don't believe that that our lawsuit would makes that point. No.
This is going into the court system. Can you talk us through the process? Where are you in court? What would the timeline of something like this be?
Yeah, so we filed our suit this week. We filed it on Tuesday. We served the governor with the lawsuit. The governor now has a chance to respond to the lawsuit. And then the court will have an opportunity to, hear arguments from both sides, depending on which motions are filed and go from there. I think it's certainly likely that no matter what happens at the circuit court level, there could be an appeal. So this lawsuit could go on for some time here into the foreseeable future. Difficult to say at this point exactly how fast or how slow it could go. It really depends on any number of factors out there. So,
well, Carol on Facebook writes, I wonder if it'll make it to court before the mandate expires. Is this something that you think could happen before the expiration, at least of the current order on masks on September 28th?
Yeah, it's certainly possible that we don't get an answer out of the circuit court before then. I can't guarantee that we would or we wouldn't. Of course, this is a situation that's likely to repeat itself going into the future. So we would hope that even in that case, that the court would still hear the arguments and make a decision, because this isn't just about the one-time use of this power. This is about an interpretation and the declaration of what the governor's statutory power is going forward, so that everybody knows what it is and that this power isn't abused in the future.
Talking to Lucas Weber, deputy counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, looking at the group's legal challenge. They're representing three Wisconsin residents challenging the governor's second emergency order on COVID-19. The main effect there so far is the mask mandate. Lucas, though, I want to turn to another issue that WILL is involved in while we have you. You're asking the state Supreme Court to invalidate a county-level order, Dane County's in this case, banning in-person school, public and private, for grades 3 through 12. A lot of the impact there on private schools, most of the public schools, already at least starting virtual. Tell us about the case you're bringing.
Yeah, so in Dane County, last week Friday, just after 5 p.m., the Dane County Health Officer issued an order that prevents all schools in the county. It applies to public and private schools alike. All schools in the county from opening for in-person instruction in grades 3 and above. So grades kindergarten, first, and second can be in person, but nobody else can. Those same students, however, can attend their schools as long as their schools are offering daycare for them, childcare, but they can't go there to learn on a daily basis. We represent 8 families, 5 schools, and 2 associations in filing an original action petition with the state Supreme Court. We're asking the state Supreme Court to intervene because the statutes simply do not give a county health department the authority to order the closure of schools for in-person instruction. And even if they did, Public Health of Madison and Dane County here has not shown that the order itself is necessary to meet the statutory burden. And it also infringes on parents' constitutional rights, you know, the right to direct the education and upbringing of their children by sending them to school to receive in-person instruction. And it also unconstitutionally infringes on the constitutional right of parents to freely exercise their religion, which in many cases includes sending their children to private religious schools to receive religious instruction and formation. So we are asking the court to weigh in and to strike down those provisions of the Dane County order, which purport to prohibit that in-person instruction. And we've also asked the court in that case for immediate relief. We asked for an immediate injunction. The court on Tuesday ordered the, on Wednesday ordered the Dane County Health Commissioner to respond by Friday at 4 p.m. So, you know, we will see a response tomorrow.
And are you hoping, kind of racing against the clock here for opening day for a lot of these schools?
Yeah, many of these schools were actually scheduled to open this week already. Some of them were even open already when the order came out and were forced to shut down in-person instruction. It really puts a lot of uncertainty into this and in flux. These are schools that invested a significant amount of money into making sure that they could come back to school safely. You know, they reconfigured their classrooms. They bought personal protective equipment and disinfectant supplies. And families who are now completely upended throughout this whole thing. Families that were counting on, you know, their children going to school every day are now having to figure out, scramble and figure out what they need to do to ensure their children are safe all day and able to learn. So we are hoping that we can get that immediate relief as quickly as possible so that these kids can get back in school and these schools can continue to teach in person, which is what they want to do.
The argument, I think, from a public health officer doing something like this would be it's not necessarily just about the kids themselves. The worry is, are we going to start creating new hotspots for a disease in a community? There's a even wider interest than just the interests of the parents, kids, and school districts, though those are very real, too. Does a public health agency have the authority to shut down a large gathering, in this case a school, with these wider concerns?
You know, I think there are perhaps individualized circumstances where a public health officer could weigh in. However, some kind of a blanket closure, as they've imposed on Dane County, is inappropriate. And frankly, as we say in our pleadings, it's not necessary because, you know, it's in Dane County, you're closing schools for in-person instruction, but those same schools are allowed to be open as long as they're childcare settings. So you can send your child to learn at school, but they have to learn virtually. They can't receive in-person instruction. So it's on some level just confusing for parents who don't really understand why it's being made that way. But it's also illegal because Dane County Public Health doesn't have the statutory authority to take the actions that they've taken here. And that's what we're hopeful the Supreme Court will declare in the very near future.
Are there public health measures you've seen here taken in Wisconsin that do pass, as you see it, constitutional muster that you can get behind?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, there's a number of provisions in emergency order number 9 that are not being challenged in this order. You know, mm-hmm. I think I'd hesitate to start taking some off the top of my head here, but I think there are a number of measures that have been taken throughout this process. You know, I mean, at the state level, getting back to our other lawsuit, at the state level, You know, the governor's given 60 days at the start of any emergency to unilaterally take action and get the ball rolling. And during that 60-day period and thereafter, he's going to have to eventually start working with others and developing a cohesive plan going forward. And we haven't seen that. That's what led to our other lawsuit. We've seen public health departments that are, again, just trying to make declarations beyond their statutory authority, which again, isn't helpful, and it's not legal. It's why we have these laws, and we want to make sure that we hold everyone accountable to them.
Briefly, as we wrap up, some in the state Senate, Republicans in particular, have talked about reconvening to overturn the executive order and clarify. Would you see that as a preferable solution to the court route?
Certainly, yeah. I think that would, if they were to overturn the governor's unlawful second state of emergency, that would be the easiest way to provide the oversight on that. Certainly always preferable when the other branches of government protect their statutory and constitutional powers.
Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Lucas Weber is the deputy counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We talked to him today about Will's lawsuit challenging Governor Evers' second COVID emergency order. And that's the one that was used as a justification for the ongoing statewide mask mandate. We also touched on the group's request to the state Supreme Court to invalidate Dane County's order that bars in-person school instruction for most students. You can find more coverage of those court cases over at WPR.org, and you can weigh in. A lot of people have weighed in on the mask mandate in particular on social media. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and share your thoughts there, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. We talked earlier this week with travel expert and public TV host Rick Steves about keeping a traveler's mindset even when you can't really go too far during a pandemic. He had some great advice. You can listen back at our archives at WPR.org/Central Time. Since then, we spotted a couple of interesting international travel destinations that are worth maybe thinking about, even if we can't visit them in person. One, an international happiness museum has opened up in Copenhagen, Denmark. The museum tells the story of what makes us happy, the changing concept of happiness, and what's in a smile, and why some places seem to be happier than others. Denmark, for example, the second happiest country in the world, according to some research. The museum was started by the Happiness Research Institute by popular demand, apparently. A lot of people wanted to visit the institute, thinking it was going to be something between a bouncy house and Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, when it was really just a handful of researchers staring at data on their computer screens. Item two, Japan is in the midst of an ongoing effort to bring tourists to new areas with a series of unique manhole covers showing Pokemon characters. Their latest round of creatures showed up in a park in Tokyo. They include early creations like Charmander and Squirtle. Gotta catch them all, but maybe just photos. I don't think they would take kindly to tourists carrying off the manhole covers for their personal collections. Central Time, I choose you. This is the Ideas Network.